Good morning, everybody. I want to thank my good friend of almost 40-plus years, the Vice President of the United States, for coming today. I don't think there's ever been a Vice President who is as steeped in foreign policy, as knowledgeable, and his instincts are as honed as Vice President Joe Biden's. And he, believe it or not, began his visits to China as a young senator on the first visit to meet with Deng Xiaoping in 1979. And he has been many times since and has received many Chinese leaders here. I will tell you that the Vice President, on so many different issues in the discussions that we have, has just an inherent native sense of direction with respect to foreign policy. And I won't say too much more here except to say that we who had the privilege of working with him in the Senate, I think I was there with him for 26 years, saw a person whose word is good, whose instincts are sound, and whose principles and values are just as basic and as based in America and in common sense as you could desire. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Vice President Wang, I hope you understand not to believe a word of what the Secretary just said. The one thing I do know for sure, that this strategic and economic dialogue is essential to get right for both our countries. There's no more important relationship. State Council Yang, it's good to see you again. I am honored to be with you. I point out the State Councilor, we've known each other for a while. His elocution and his mastery of English exceeds mine, and so I seek his advice occasionally on speeches. But honored to welcome your delegation to Washington. I want to start by expressing my sadness, the sadness of, quite frankly, the American people in the loss of two beautiful young lives, young Chinese students in the Asiana plane crash on Saturday. Our sympathies to their families and to your country. It was remarkable to see that plane and the state it was in, and but those loss of those two young lives is for families the most devastating thing that happens in their lives. You know, we meet at a time of transition on both sides. China has a new president and new leaders. I've had the great pleasure and honor of spending a fair amount of time with President Xi when President Hu and President Obama thought the two vice presidents should get to know one another, and we ended up spending about 10 days together, five in each of our countries, traveling around, and you get to know someone fairly well. When I congratulated him on his elevation, I asked if he could possibly help me. But he made no commitment whatsoever. But all kidding aside, we welcome and look forward to the transition that's taking place on both sides. And Vice Premier, I want you to know that in the persons of John Kerry and Jack Lew, as part of the changing the guard here, we have sent you, in this meeting, two of the best, most seasoned, qualified public servants that this nation has to offer. And that is not hyperbole. They generally are. I think Jack's had every job in the administration, he sometimes in our meetings gets confused whether he's supposed to be calling for spending less money or more money, based on whether he's a director of OMB or the Secretary of Treasury. But all kidding aside, this transition that's taken place in the last 6 months or so is important in that I think it's vitally important that the relationships among the four men behind me are deepened and become more personal. I look out and see our trade rep. He's heard me say that there's a famous American politician, a former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and he used to say, all politics is local. Well, I think a significant part of international politics, foreign policy, is personal. Trust. One of the most important things that we need to continue to establish and deepen between our peoples and between our governments is trust. We don't have to agree on everything, but you have to trust. And I think it's in building these relationships, both our countries will be much better for it in the years ahead. The stakes are very high, because it's fair to say that the dynamic that emerges between our nations will affect not just our peoples, but quite frankly, have a significant impact on the entire world. And let me be blunt. There are strong voices on both sides of the Pacific that talk about a relationship in terms of mistrust and suspicion. They still exist in both our countries. Our relationship is subject to all kinds of caricatures. I've heard the U.S.-China relationship described as everything from the next Cold War to the new G2. And the truth is, neither are accurate. Neither are accurate. The truth is more complicated. Our relationship is and will continue to be, God willing, a mix of competition and cooperation. And competition can be good for both of us, and cooperation is essential. For two nations as large and influential as ours, it's only natural that there be competition. And if the game is fair and healthy political and economic competition can then marshal the best energies of both our societies. But this, this mix places an added burden on both of us. The relationship, a relationship like ours, will work only if the leaders and citizens approach it with a sense of vision and a spirit of maturity. We will have our disagreements. We have them now. But if we are straightforward, clear, and predictable with one another, we can find solutions that work for both of us. I made clear in my last visit to China that we are a Pacific power. We have been, and we're going to remain one. That should be viewed, and in my discussions in China, was viewed by many as a stabilizing influence. But as we implement President Obama's policy of rebalancing toward the Asia-Pacific, it's important that the United States and China communicate clearly and work closely with one another on what is going on. We have big issues to deal with. We each have important contributions to make to global and economic stability. And in my country has been, in the last 4 years, grappling with such challenges as infrastructure, education, our fiscal picture. Too many Americans still remain out of work. But China faces serious challenges as well. It needs to create high-skilled jobs for young people, deal with grave environmental problems, reform China's banking sector to respond to market forces, and bring its shadow financial sector to heel. The United States is making progress. Our economy has now added private sector jobs for 40 consecutive months. Not enough, in the view of this administration, but 40 consecutive months. The manufacturing sector is once again growing at the fastest pace in decades. And our deficit next year is projected to be less than half of what it was in 2009 as a share of our economy. And the next step China needs, and the next steps that China needs to take for its own economy happen to be in the interest of the United States as well. Your own plans call for the kinds of changes that have to take place that are difficult, like here. But if they do, they will benefit us both, including freeing exchange rates, shifting to a consumption-led economy, enforcing intellectual property rights and renewed innovation. You know, it's easy for pundits to point out to us and both our countries what we need to do. But they're political realities. These things are not easy to do quickly, but they must be done. Some argue that China should continue on its current path, enhancing some aspects of its free market system while rising political openness gradually occurs, maintaining the state's deep involvement in the Chinese economy. I do not pretend to know whether with any degree of certainty, precision, what will allow China to rise above those economic challenges. But I believe that history offers us both some lessons. History shows that prosperity is greatest when governments allow not just the free exchange of goods, but the free exchange of ideas. That innovation, which thrives in open economies and societies, thrives in open economies and societies. That that's the currency of the 21st century success. That in the long run, greater openness, transparency, and respect for universal rights actually is a source of national and international stability. And as I've said before, I believe that China, presumptuous of me, but will be stronger and more stable and more innovative if it represents and respects international human rights norms. But there are differences we have. We also have significant challenges, strategic challenges to discuss. Together, we need to be addressing the long-standing disagreements, and when sensitive issues arise, work hard not to create new ones. For example, your military is modernizing and expanding its presence in Asia. Ours is updating its global posture as two wars come to an end, and we recalibrate and rebalance in Asia. These trends will bring us into closer contact. Leaving the military dimension of our dialogue underdeveloped on both sides causes us to run unnecessary risk. So I welcomed yesterday the round of strategic security dialogue and the enhanced dialogue between our senior military leaders. More of it must occur. It's critical to expand our military dialogue, exchanges, and cooperation as we go forward. We have to know what each other are doing. The truth is, we have a common interest in defending a wide range of public goods and international rules that will only grow more compelling as China looks beyond its borders. For example, we both benefit from freedom of navigation and uninhibited lawful commerce. That will deepen, it will also become more apparent in the need, and it will depend on how China approaches its territorial disputes with its neighbors and how we work together to advance common interest. We both will benefit from an open, secure, reliable internet. Outright cyber-enabling theft that U.S. companies are experiencing now must be viewed as out of bounds and needs to stop. The race to develop cleaner, more affordable energy sources through a mix of competition and cooperation, to state the obvious, can benefit both our people and the people in the world. So I welcome the new energy and climate dialogue and our agreement to reduce the pollutants known as HFCs, which make an outsized contribution to climate change. And of course, the security of both our nations, as we have discussed privately and somewhat publicly, is threatened by North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Neither of us will accept a North Korea that is a nuclear-armed state. Our presidents have agreed that ending that threat is a critical priority not only in our relationship, but for each of our nations. We're determined to intensify our cooperation with China to denuclearize North Korea. Many of the most pressing challenges will be very difficult to solve, unless we are willing to continue to work together as we are doing today and have been doing for some time. China now has the second largest economy in the world, and God willing, will continue to grow. It's in our interest. This is no longer the discussion when I was a young senator of zero-sum games here. We used to talk about if another nation grows and benefits somehow that it's the exact opposite, to state the obvious. With that emerging and continuing growth of the Chinese economy and the second largest in the world now, that's the good news. The bad news is it comes with some new international responsibilities. It's understandable that China wants to be involved in international rule setting, as you should be, but is wary about taking additional international burdens on. Ultimately, the two go hand in hand. Because in 2013, the world's environment and rule-based economic order cannot sustain an exception the size of China. Your country is simply too immense and too important. As John pointed out, I first visited China in 1976 as a young senator. It was already clear then that China stood on the cusp of remarkable change. I believed then, and I believe now, that your country's rise would be and is good for America and the world. That is just a simple statement of fact. But it's never been inevitable. The greatest cause for optimism was what happens when our people come together. We see a lot of ourselves in each other. A striving entrepreneurial spirit, an optimism about the future. I see that when I speak to young Americans across this country. And I saw it when I was accompanied by your president and spoke to college students in Chengdu. Mechanisms like the Strategic Economic Dialogue play an important role in managing our complex relationship. If together we get it right, we can leave behind a much better future for our children and for their children, and quite frankly, for the world. That sounds somewhat chauvinistic to us to be talking about as we get our relationship right, it has such a consequence for the world, but it does. It does. And nothing matters more. So I welcome you. I know this is your not the first day, but I welcome you on behalf of the President, and I wish you a great deal of luck. We have a great deal of work to do. The promise is real. The competition will, in fact, as I said to President Xi when he was Vice President, the competition is good. It's good for us. It's good for you. We welcome it. We welcome it. And we'll both be better for it. As I said, as a consequence, if we get it right, so will the world. So thank you for the important work you're doing here today. I wish you luck the remainder of this discussion, and I look forward to seeing you in China. Thank you.